Hey everyone, and welcome to Chef AJ Live. I'm your host, Chef AJ, and this is where I introduce you to amazing people like you who are doing great things in the world that I think you should know about. Well, today is the third Friday of the month, which means it's time for the Doctor Is In Q&A with Ron Weiss, MD, where he answers the questions that you have previously submitted to us at chefaj.com. So without further ado, we have a bouncing Dr. Ron Weiss.
Hello, everyone. Hello, Chef AJ.
Hi. Well, you know, are you riding a little horsey?
Well, I have. Yeah, I'm in a little bit of a different environment today. I am at home. Usually I'm in the office, you know, seeing patients. Today, we had a short day because I am leaving later this evening to go to Oxford. The Oxford Literary Festival is held once a year, and I have been invited to interview Colin Campbell on
Well,
stage
that
at
is
Oxford.
Quite the honor.
I know it is. I'm very excited.
Well, good for you. So tell me about the bouncing. Dr. Greger used to walk on a treadmill during his interviews. He stopped because people were getting dizzy. What is the bouncing?
Oh, you know, I'm just trying to make myself comfortable in front of the computer. And, you know, I do some rotational movements on the ball and my SI joints. You know, I don't use it a lot, but in this setting, I thought it would be kind of neat.
Great.
I'll try to keep the bouncing to a minimum.
That's okay. It doesn't bother me at all. I just think it's different. So if you're ready, we have so many questions that were submitted this month, and we still have several from previous months. So let's just get right into it with the first question from Dawn. And she wants to know, what do you suggest for bone health if you're a vegan? Because she said she has some friends that followed an exclusively SOS-free diet for several years, and between them, they've broken over 6 bones. And she did research on vegans, and she found that it seems that the vegan diet is really not good for your bones. And when she has been eating vegan for 5 weeks, she cracked a vertebra in her spine. So what do you think about bone health and veganism?
Okay. Well, to start off with, you know, bones, your skeleton, bones are living tissues. They're not inanimate rocks. They're made out of a mineral matrix or a framework, but within the bones, there are also living cells that both build and break down bones. And so, basically, what you want to do is you want to have the optimal balance of between the building up cells, the forces that build up, and the forces that break down. Having a vegan diet for 5 weeks and then breaking a bone, I don't see the correlation between those two things, because osteoporosis and bone demineralization is a chronic long-term problem. So it doesn't occur in 5 weeks. It occurs over many, many years. So, you know, when we were all growing up, Chef AJ, our mothers and told us to drink a lot of milk for strong bones, right? We now know that the people who drink the most milk get the most hip fractures. So that definitely is not necessarily true. The question is, would eating, you know, what role does eating play in the bone health? And would eating a vegan diet predispose you, as this lady has suggested, to getting bone fractures? And sure enough, we were talking about Oxford before. There was a recent study from the University of Oxford that did identify an increase in fractures in plant-eating people who ate vegetarian or vegan. There was an increase. And I remember Dr. Furman analyzing this study, and it was his feeling that the reason why most of these plant-eating people probably had an increase in fractures may have been because they were protein deficient. I know that's a big subject, right? Because people in the plant world always laugh that they're being asked, where do you get your protein from? But it is possible to be protein deficient and not get enough calcium if you do not have a well-planned plant-based diet. So we encourage all of our patients, especially as they get older, because you need extra protein not only to rebuild your bones, but also to help maintain muscle mass, because muscles are made out of protein. We encourage all of our patients to eat at least 60 grams, 60 grams of protein a day. And you may ask, well, what about the calcium then? Where do you get that from? Because most of the protein source that patients are eating are coming from legumes. Legumes have a lot of calcium too. And because a lot of our patients, we encourage them to eat a lot of dark leafy greens. They have a lot of calcium. So those two together, the dark leafy greens and the legumes, should give you enough protein and your calcium so that you don't have a problem. Of course, there are other minerals in bones, but you know, a well-rounded whole food plant-based diet has all those minerals that you need. So we talked about the nutritional requirements to have healthy bones. Let's see. And then the other thing is, which I think is critical, is the loading forces that are placed on the bones. They play at least as an important, if not more important, role in maintaining good, dense bones. So there, and that's a very interesting field. We know that not all exercises are created equal when it comes to building bones. For example, a lot of people like to walk, but that may not necessarily be able to reverse bone, loss of bone density, or running may not be able to. Recent studies have shown that jumping is a good kind of exercise to help build your bones. So we encourage our patients to have jumping exercises, as well as exercises that build their core muscle strength, like squats. Sometimes we incorporate the jumps with the squats into what's known as jump squats. And so that's what I would advise. And in our patients who have osteoporosis, when they do all of these, put these together and also maintain an adequate vitamin D level. So it's the three things: the adequate vitamin D level, the at least eating the 60 grams of protein per day, mostly coming from legumes, with the dark leafy greens, the calcium. And if they do the loading exercises, I don't remember a patient that did not reverse their bone density. It usually is very effective, and they improve.
Right. And also, when somebody says they broke a bone, what are the circumstances? Because if you're in an, like, I've been vegan almost 50 years, I have broken bones, but they were as a result of serious accidents, not like just sitting in my chair and breaking a bone. You know what I
Yeah,
mean?
and it is. Look, I was when I was maybe about 15 years ago or 20 years ago, I was swinging my kids around when they were little, and I got dizzy and I fell against the arm of the couch. I broke my rib when I was in my early 40s, but that doesn't mean you have osteoporosis. You are correct. If you apply enough force at a specific angle to a bone, it will break, even if you have good bone mineralization.
Right. Great. Well, thanks, Dr. Weiss. A vegan diet gets blamed for a lot of things that it may not actually be causing.
True.
Yep. Great. Well, the next question is from Susan, and it's on cellulitis. And she said, What could be causing me to have the beginning of cellulitis happening every couple of months on the side of some of my fingernails? I have an antibiotic cream that takes it away, but I'd like to get to the root cause.
Well, I'm not sure that the proper term is cellulitis. What is cellulitis? Usually doctors reserve that term for a soft tissue infection, an infection of the skin and the subcutaneous tissues below it. It usually occurs, it can occur on any part of the body, from the face to the trunk to the limbs. But in my life, I almost never remember it occurring on the edges of the fingernails where the folds of the flesh are. And if it does, that kind of infection or redness or swelling is called a paronychia. It has a different name. Yes, it is a cellulitis. It is an infection of the soft tissues and skin, but we don't call it cellulitis. We call it paronychia, paronychia, which means aside. Nychia is nail. Para means aside or next to the nail. And we do see basically when people get paronychias, they get bacterial accumulation under the fold of the nail. The skin comes, the appendiceal area or the flesh around the nail comes and it folds over and onto the nail where the cuticle is. And either biting the nails, so we should ask this lady if she's biting her nails, manicures, manipulation of the cuticle, that can lead to disruption of this intersection where the nail fold is. So if this lady is doing any of that, I would reconsider it. I mean, I know a lot of ladies get manicures today. I would think, and the other context I've come across is in nail biters, or not necessarily nail biters, but cuticle biters. People who are always trying to put their cuticle in their mouth, because the mouth has a lot of bacteria. So, those are the two contexts I could think of that might predispose to infections in this area, and it should be overcomable. If the other reason why people would get recurrent infections, which are a little odd like this, is because they have an immune system which is not fighting or defending them. But that wouldn't just give infections where the nail edges are. That would give infections all over the place. So I think that this is a specific, there's a specific set of circumstances in this patient that is leading to these infections around the nail, and it probably is one of those items.
Great. Well, we will ask for more follow-up. Thank you. Okay, the next question is on tetanus shots from Victoria. Is it advisable or even necessary for a woman in her late 70s to get a tetanus shot during her physical appointment when it's been several years since her last tetanus shot?
So, tetanus vaccinations, and this leads to a broader overall category of vaccinations in general. But tetanus vaccinations are recommended by the federal authority that guides us on vaccine advice every 10 years to be given. This lady says she's gotten them several years ago. So if it's several years ago, then she definitely does not need it because that's not a decade. And these days, the tetanus vaccine, well, so what is a tetanus vaccine used for? It is used to prevent tetanus. What is tetanus? Or in the old days, known as lockjaw. It is a almost universally fatal illness that's very rare. I think I have only encountered one case in my entire life, and I've been practicing medicine for almost 40 years. And if you get tetanus, you're gonna probably end up dead. because it is a fatal disease, a severe disease, and it's thought that at least 50% of tetanus infections, we don't even know what the cause is. The person gets this tetanus bacteria in them, and it causes their body to seize up and go into severe muscular spasm, and they die. However, about half of them we do know comes from dirty wounds. Wounds that were infected, let's say from the soil or a rusty nail that goes into you, or an unclean cut, and that the Clostridium tetani, which is a soil bacteria, can get in there and start causing problems. So it's very rare. I give tetanus all the time, tetanus vaccines, because it's recommended that when I work in urgent care, I sew up lacerations, and it's a standard of care to inquire, to question a person who's come in with a laceration if they're getting it sewn up, because you would not want to sew up Clostridium tetani bacteria into a wound, because then it's closed and they're anaerobic bacteria and they love to grow inside the body without oxygen. That's why they're dangerous. So I give them at that point, but the other point I would recommend that the tetanus vaccine being given is if you have a baby who is coming into the family, let's say if this is a grandma who's asking this, and one of your kids is having a child, and you're going to have a new grandchild, the tetanus vaccine these days are combined with pertussis. Pertussis, or whooping cough, is a deadly disease for young children, especially within the first year, 6 months, or year of life, because they have no ability to fight it off, and it can be lethal to them. So it has been recommended that we vaccinate adults with this tetanus pertussis vaccine who are going to come in contact with young children so that they don't carry pertussis to them. That's the other reason why I would get it. Otherwise, I definitely would not get it short of 10 years, this vaccine. And that's my philosophy with the tetanus vaccine.
Thank you. All right. This next question is from Bet. And she said, I have a moderate amount of proteinuria, unknown cause. I'm 100% plant-based SOS free and not diabetic or overweight, and my kidney function is good. Would you recommend a kidney biopsy?
Well, so what is a kidney biopsy? A kidney biopsy is when a doctor, your doctor doesn't know exactly why you have a kidney problem. There are many, many, many diseases that can affect the kidney, and can disrupt its function and degrade its ability to dialyze or clean out your blood. And the reason for doing a biopsy is to get a tissue sample of the kidney, look at it under the microscope, and give you an exact diagnosis as to why you have the problem. So, that having been said, kidney biopsies are not done lightly. Out of the many organs that are biopsied, nephrologists usually are somewhat reluctant to do kidney biopsies unless they must. And the reason why is, they are not without potential risk, kidney biopsies. In the old days when I was training, when I was doing my training and my residency with a nephrologist, kidney biopsies, if you can believe it or not, were blind. Get this, Dr. AJ. You used to bend the patient over, take a long needle, and go blindly into their back where the kidney was without any assistance from imaging and hope that you hit the kidney. Sometimes you would hit an artery. And that's why there was a mortality rate associated with kidney biopsy. But these days, nephrologists, from what I can see, they never really do it anymore. The biopsies are done by special procedures. They're done by radiologists, and they're guided with ultrasound, and they know that exactly where they're going in the kidney. But still, there's always risks to everything. I'm guessing that this person who's asking the question probably went to a nephrologist who has recommended a kidney biopsy. It may be worth for you to get a second opinion because not all nephrologists want kidney biopsies. The decision to do a kidney biopsy is based on suspicion of what you have, what kidney disease you have, what is causing the protein in your urine, and if there's something we can do about it to help it. Like, can you go on a drug to help it? When I say do something, I mean a drug. The exciting thing about what you've done is you're already on a whole food plant-based diet. And in my experience, that is very powerful in its ability to help a whole host of chronic kidney diseases, including protein losing kidney disease. In fact, we had a, if you go to our website, we have a testimonial. The website is ethosprimarycare.com. In our healing conversations, we have the story of a Casey. It was a young woman who had a lot of protein in her urine because she had a specific problem, which was called IgA nephropathy. And by eating a whole food plant-based diet, she was able to get rid of it and have children, which was not thought to be possible. And I've seen other cases with significant, sometimes a few grams of protein. That means like 2,000-3,000 milligrams of protein in the urine per day resolve. So what I'm trying to tell you is, if I don't know how much protein you have in your urine, but if it's minimal, or if it's going down, I think you have time to wait. And if your kidney function is good, and if there are other inflammatory markers in your blood are good, if there are my kidneys, I would tend to wait and see. If you haven't been on the plant-based diet very long, eat it for a year or so and see what would happen. And remember, you can always get a second opinion from a nephrologist because I've seen nephrologists, I've had patients go to nephrologists. One will say, get a kidney biopsy. The other one will say, no. And especially if your kidneys are in good working order, I don't really think there may not be a reason to really get the kidney biopsy because what kind of drugs or treatment are they going to give you as long as the plant-based diet is working well? Probably not very much.
Yep. Great. Thanks. Okay. This is from Anonymous. And the question is, I don't think I've heard Dr. Weiss address Lyme's disease before. And have you had success treating it since New Jersey has one of the highest rates? If so, what protocol do you use? Because this is a person that's 86 years old, lives in Connecticut, and 100% whole food plant-based over 30 years and doesn't want to take any meds.
Well, you may after you hear my story. Our farm is in Long Valley, Morris County, New Jersey. The farm is a 300-year-old working farm, and we have the Morris County and our town where our farm is has the highest incidence, the last time I checked, the highest incidence of Lyme disease in the nation. And there are not many people that I've met in town who have not had Lyme disease. It's assumed that you have had it. So ubiquitous is this problem. About 2 years ago, 2 summers ago, was it? I I got an application to be recredentialed from Morristown Memorial Medical Center, which is where I'm on staff, and they wanted me to fill out their physical form. So I gave it to our nurse practitioner, Nathaniel. Nathaniel took my pulse rate for the form and said, "Hey, Dr. Weiss, are you aware that your heart rate is irregular?" I said, "Get out of here. It's not." He said, "Yes, it is." I took my pulse. I was missing heartbeats. I said, "That is odd. I've never had that happen before." I went to the urgent care, had an EKG done, and I was in a heart block. I was in Wenckebach. It's a specific kind of heart block where the electrical conduction of your heart is dysfunctioning. And if it progresses, it can lead into a bad situation where your heart's not beating right. So I checked myself into the hospital, and it turns out I had Lyme disease, cardiac Lyme. And I know how I got it too. I was weeding in a native wet meadow garden on our farm. And while I was in the hospital, there were periods of time where my heart was not beating for 3.5 seconds, which is a long time. It was so long that the nurse would run into the room and say, "Dr. Weiss, are you okay?" to check if I was still alive. So sometimes my heart rate went into the 30s. So the reason why I'm telling you this story is to illustrate that you should not fool around with Lyme disease if you have it, because it can kill you. And you don't know who it's going to kill, but there are not many people who get Lyme disease who are not significantly affected, whether the Lyme parasites go into your brain, which I have had patients that happen. They go into your heart, they go into your joints. So I would take antibiotics if I were you. I think that's very, very important. I'm one of the biggest advocates against antibiotic use, except where it is specifically needed, and it is specifically needed here. Do not take any chances. Take the antibiotics. Go to a good doctor. And here's the other thing I would avoid. Avoid Lyme disease specialists, because in general, there are a lot of doctors who've cropped up who have made a business of treating people for chronic Lyme disease with cycles and cycles of antibiotics, which destroy your microbiome. And we don't have evidence that the Lyme parasite is bacteria is present in these people. I personally think that people experiencing chronic Lyme disease are suffering from a post-inflammatory state. They are not crazy. They're not imagining it. It is a real condition. It is a post-infectious inflammatory state that I personally have had a number of patients who have completely rid themselves of the chronic Lyme disease by going high-level whole food. So I know it's possible. If you have acute Lyme, get it treated appropriately with antibiotics. Usually that would mean like 4 weeks of something like doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. But you're better now, right, Dr. Weiss?
Yes, I'm fine. Thank God.
Well, so good on Nathaniel for figuring that out for you, huh?
Nathaniel. Shout out to Nathaniel Smith. Thank you, Nathaniel.
I'll tell him. Maybe he's watching. Thank you, Dr. Weiss. All right. This next question is from Joe. And this is kind of similar to the bone breaking question, but it's about teeth. And she asks, could whole food plant-based eating cause more tooth decay than the SAD diet? I know that Dr. Weiss is not a dentist, but would he have any specific advice for healthy teeth? At 65, after 3 years of joyful, fully compliant whole food plant-based eating and no indication of teeth problems on x-rays taken in 2021, two unrelated dentists recommended removing five molars. They both separately insist I'll require prophylactic antibiotics and painkillers that I want to do my utmost to avoid. Both recommended very expensive and time-consuming implants. You know, the thing is, cause doesn't always equal effect. You know what I
Exactly.
mean?
You know, that's it. These are two good questions that you brought up, Chef AJ. The one with the, I adopted a plant-based diet 6 weeks ago and now I broke my rib and I've been eating plants for 3 years and now my molars have to be removed. So, right, just because something happens while you're doing something, it doesn't mean that those two things are related, right? And it doesn't even mean there's an association. And in this case, there isn't, I don't believe there's no medical basis or scientific basis for an association with your molar problem. So here's my general overview of the teeth. Most Americans have teeth problems. And the reason why we have teeth problems is because of sugar. Because we've all eaten a lot of sugar in our lives. That's why. There you go. That's it. And here's the other thing. By the time you get you're chewing and chewing and chewing and chewing, well, what happens with the sugar is the sugar causes cavities. And then you have to have fillings because of the cavities. And then once the tooth's architecture and form is disrupted, that surface, that beautiful enameled surface, and by the way, enamel is one of the hardest, it is the hardest surface in our body, and it's one of the hardest surfaces anywhere. But once that's why the dentist needs diamond tip drill bits to get through it. But once that enamel is disrupted, like because you had a cavity and the dentist had to remove the cavity, they had to drill it out, and then they had to put a filling in. The structure is never the same. You'll have a filling in there, and then the filling, no fillings last forever. Then the filling degrades, then bacteria get underneath the filling, then the filling is undermined, then you get all sorts of problems. That's why it's good never to get cavities to begin with. So I don't know if this lady, there are not many of us who reach 65 years of age, having eaten a stand, regular omnivorous diet in America, that don't have fillings in their molars. I mean, what about you, AJ?
What do you mean?
Do you have fillings in your molars?
I don't believe I do.
Well, I know I do.
Maybe I do. I
I've
don't.
had, since I was a child, I've had fillings and mercury, silver fillings in my molars. So, in any event, once you have those, once the surface has been compromised by work, then it's likelihood that eventually the tooth itself will, years and years and years and decades away, there's a good chance it could have problems. So I don't know why this lady needs to have her molars removed, but that may be the reason why. Okay. And I'm not saying they do have to be removed. You have to be careful because, dentists have different ideas. Different dentists have different ideas and different ways of doing things. Some are conservative, some are more aggressive. You may want to get some more opinions before having your molars removed. The other thing is that keeping, dental hygiene, which is keeping your gum line clean, keeping plaque development off the teeth is essential to keeping those teeth and not having them removed. I use something called gum, GUM. It's a rubber tip little pick. It makes sure plaque doesn't develop, and you can use this pick and go in between the teeth and then rub it on the surface of the teeth near the gum line. Those are very helpful. Of course, flossing every day is excellent. Brushing your teeth, of course. And I think if I had to say one thing, the one thing that I am aware of, and I think it's the only thing that the science shows, that plant-based eating people are potentially more prone to regarding dental problems is fruit acids. Because we eat fruit, fruit has acid in it, and then the acid can wear away that hard enamel surface. And if it does that, then you can have problems. So I tell all of our patients that they should not graze throughout the day, but eat their food and be done with it, and then rinse out the mouth for 1 minute with water to dilute out and neutralize the fruit acids. And then you should wait an hour before brushing your teeth so you don't use the acid as a scouring agent and scour the acid into the teeth. The other advice I would give for teeth and plant-based eaters is don't drink lemon water. Be careful of that. I've seen people who've lost the enamel on their teeth because of that. And if you decide to do drink acidic things like lemon water or like hibiscus tea, which is very acidic, drink it through a straw. Drink it, get over it through a straw, and then rinse your mouth out with water after to neutralize the acid. So as far as eating plants, to summarize, I think it's the acid exposure from fruits and acid-bearing plants that are your main concern. Otherwise, oh, you should have a very healthy mouth, and you shouldn't get cavities, and you should retain your, as long as you do the tooth hygiene like I described, you shouldn't have teeth problems at all.
But it just is so interesting that the line of reasoning in these questions is that, people have followed whatever diet they followed or whatever lifestyle habits they followed for a very long time. And so these things could have been brewing all these years, but then they've been vegan 1, 2, 3 years, and then now they blame the vegan diet for something that probably was chronic or they always had. You know what I mean?
Well, you know why that is?
No, I don't.
It's the opposite of what Dr. McDougall says. I think it's because of two reasons. Dr. McDougall says people love to hear good news about their bad habits. But on the obverse of that is maybe people are looking to hear sometimes a reason to get out of, looking to find a reason to maybe release them or to give them a permission slip not to do this. Because, it's not easy to eat a plant-based whole foods diet consistently year in, year out. That may be something. But the other thing is that I think we all have a tendency, when something happens to us that's out of the blue, we all have a tendency to think, oh my God, this happened today on Friday, and I started doing this on Tuesday. Are these two things connected? Like, for example, we had a gentleman who was recently diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. And, the pancreatic cancer has been growing for 20 years. I mean, the patient doesn't know this, but it started off on average about 20 years ago, and the patient adopted a plant-based whole foods diet 3 years ago. And the first question that they asked was, I guess the plant-based diet's not working, right? And what I told them is, maybe you would have been dead already if you hadn't been eating a plant-based diet, right? Look at the story of my father. His tumors reduced in by 50% in 6 months after eating a plant-based diet. So I think that it's important just to remember the reasons behind things, the evidence, and then I think you'll stay on the right.
Yeah, it's sort of like when people write in, they said, will the plant-based diet cure this disease? And so whether it will or won't, so what's the alternative? Because we know that like the keto diet and the standard American diet isn't going to cure it. So do you know what I'm saying? Like, why wouldn't you do it?
And then the other thing is that people forget that you may be focused on this disease you have, right? Well, I have diabetes. Is it going to reverse it? Yes or no? And I said, well, it probably will, but even if it doesn't, it'll prevent you from getting a heart attack or cancer. How about the other things that are coming down the line, right?
I agree with you. It's so interesting because even if the answer is no, so then you're just going to keep eating McDonald's? Okay.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Okay. This is from Annie. How does Dr. Weiss feel about vegetables that are grown hydroponically? I was able to find a source near our place that sells a different variety of veggies, but not organic like your regenerative farming.
You know, this is a big sore point with organic farmers. Did you know that, AJ?
I did not know that.
Oh, yes. There was violent objection. When the USDA, Organic Certifying Agency, agreed to allow hydroponic produce and food to be labeled as organic. Organic farmers, good organic farmers, traditional organic farmers went wild. And the reason why is because the bedrock and the source of all good things in good food and farming is the soil. So how can you create good food if you don't have soil? We think that you can't. And the reason why is because plants have very, very ancient relationships with soil and with not just soil, with a living soil. Plants are part of a vibrant ecosystem. And they build themselves, they have intimate relationships and build themselves and what they are and their quality and the quality of the fruits that they give and the leaves that they produce are a factor of the life in the soil from which they derive their nutrients. So if you just stick a plant in water, where's the life? How can how can all of these components, which are supportive of a healthy plant and excellent food, give healthy food when they're not there at all? So that's the problem. Yes, it is food, but is it healthy food? And yeah, it's a complicated thing to think about. I think not intuitively because of what I just described to you. So I know that, and this brings up another topic, Chef AJ. I think that eventually, as our environment becomes more difficult to live in, as climate change, weather events become more severe, climate becomes and weather becomes more unpredictable. I have a feeling that a lot of food will be grown indoors. It's not going to be grown in soil anymore. I think it will be grown hydroponically in warehouses because it's a very controlled environment. And I believe the quality and nutrition of the food will suffer, most likely, but that's what's going to happen. In fact, I was reading an article a few years ago that an enormous facility, something like the size of 50 football fields, was opened up in Kentucky a few years ago to supply tomatoes to the eastern seaboard of the United States. All hydroponic. I personally would stay away from it because of what I just said.
Okay, thank you for clarifying. All right. Next question is from Nancy. Dr. Weiss, do you know when you'll be able to see patients in Michigan via telemedicine or a virtual visit?
Yeah, I think not soon. I think the issue with doctors is that we need to have medical licenses in the state where we are actually seeing the patient. Like if you wanted to come to New Jersey, I could see you. But I cannot come to Michigan and see you. I could get a Michigan license and then I could see you, but then I'd have to get 50 medical licenses. And there are doctors who do that, by the way, but it's an enormous undertaking to get multiple state licenses. So I think what I can suggest for this young lady is we do have excellent coaches like Asha and our entire coaching staff that basically they're like my right arm, and they do not need state licenses in order to help you. So you're always willing to give us a call and talk to Asha and the coaches, and they'll figure out how to help you. But unfortunately, at this time, I cannot specifically see you with the patient.
Thank you. Now, is maybe I'm wrong, but I thought my understanding was as long as their first appointment is in the state of New Jersey to get established, then the virtuals can be in other states, or that's not true?
The regulations are very muddy. Technically, the doctor is supposed to be licensed in the where the patient is living. I think that I could, in a court, I could defend myself. Well, the patient did come to see me, in New Jersey, and then I was just doing a follow-up call for them with the visit. And I saw them over telemedicine, which we do telemedicine all the time, and one visit, but not for an entire year. It's like, 6 months later, 3 months later, 12 months later, with ongoing care. That would be probably violating the state consumer affairs rules, and that's illegal.
Okay, I understand. Okay, so this is Susan is wondering. She says, I'm a healthy 70-year-old female on no medications. I've been vegetarian 10 years, whole food, plant-based, sulfas-free since 2020. While examining my dilated eyes, my ophthalmologist commented on how I must be taking very good care of myself. The optician doing my refraction said my blood vessels could be seen during the exam and they look healthy. Is it possible to generalize the healthy state of the blood vessels in my eyes to the rest of my body?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, they teach this in medical school, what this lady is saying. When you are in the second and third year of medical school and you take ophthalmology, we learn how to look in the backs of the eyes on the retina with an ophthalmoscope and diagnose high blood pressure by the way the vessels look on the eye grounds, on the retina. We learn to diagnose. So, for example, if a patient was to be mute and came into you and you didn't know anything about them, they didn't tell you anything about their history or what their medicines were on, and you were just to look in the eye ground, look through the eye exam, just to the way your eye doctor did, you would discover when patients had high blood pressure because you would have certain, the blood vessels have what's called AV nicking. They're narrowed where they cross. Or there would be bleeding. There would be bleeding events that you could see from certain other blood vessels and diabetes and such things. So when we see an older person who has, beautiful vessels and they're sleek and there are no disruptions in them and there's no debris in there, then that definitely is an indication of overall systemic vascular health.
Great, thanks. Here's a question on stevia, and it is from Maria. And she says, I take a magnesium supplement as I suffer from severe cramping. I take Cabot Health powder. One ingredient is stevia. It gives me heart palpitations and dry mouth. Is stevia bad for you?
I think all processed things are bad for you. I would not eat processed food. That's why they call it Chef AJ, a whole food plant-based diet. A lot of the times people forget the whole part, right? And I think that's why Colin Campbell wrote that book, Whole. Don't forget whole. It always has to be attached to plants. When you're taking a plant powder, yeah, who knows what that is? Does it have talcum powder cut in with that stevia powder? I don't know. No one knows. It's the same problem we have with supplements. Nobody knows what's in a supplement really because they're not regulated. And you know, when I eat a tomato, I know it. You know, when I eat a piece of kale, I know it's kale. You don't know what's going on when you take this supplement. And that brings us to, and you know, for most of the sweeteners, these nutritive sweeteners or plant-based sweeteners, or even artificial sweeteners, in my recollection, the science shows that there's been problems with them all. So I just wouldn't expose yourself to that. So
Yep.
this lady says she has cramps. I'm going to guess that it may be lower extremity cramps, like calf cramps. Did she specify?
Nope.
Well, it's that when, in my experience of practicing for decades, when a patient says, I have cramps, it's usually of the calves and the lower legs. And if that's the case, I don't think she needs to take this at all. If she does have the lower leg cramps, and especially if it's at night, which is a common time for them to occur, all she has to do is get a slant board. She can get it on Amazon. A slant board, it's a piece of wood on a on an angle, and you stand on it so your toes point upwards, the heel is downwards on the slant board. It's a wooden board. Place it against the wall, and you stand there for 5 minutes, both feet on the board, back against the wall, and you won't have leg cramps again. That's it. Do it every night, and do breathing exercises, diaphragmatic breathing exercises as you do it. If you want to, also, if you have the cramps during the day, do it when you wake up in the morning and you'll be done.
Nice. Thank you. I think we might have time for one more question because we know you have got to get to England to
Yes.
honor Dr. Colin Campbell. This is from Susan. Can Dr. Weiss talk about whether or not a whole food plant-based diet could help with psoriasis and what would his recommendation be for this condition? I've seen people water fast and it got better.
Yeah, so psoriasis is an autoimmune disease, an autoimmune disease of the skin, where the skin, just a reminder for autoimmune diseases, it means your immune system is attacking part of yourself, because there's it's been missignaled, it's been misdirected to do that. And in this specific condition of psoriasis, what happens is the autoimmune attacks cause hyper buildup, an excessive buildup of keratosis, of scaly skin layers, and they produce these silvery looking plaques that are on top of the skin. So in my experience, the whole food plant-based diet, I would say, is successful in maybe 50 to 60% of people in either resolving the psoriasis or making it demonstrably better. But then in a large minority, I've noticed that it often has little effect. And out of However, as you said before, AJ, that doesn't mean that there's not a good reason to do the whole food plant-based diet just because it didn't fix your psoriasis. Because think of it this way, you don't want other autoimmune diseases to crop up or other problems. So In these cases where it doesn't have effect, the 40 or so percent, in some of them, I have found that when gluten is cut out and wheat is avoided, there is a benefit to that in this minority of patients who don't get better on the whole food plant-based diet. So the next step would be to remove gluten in these patients, this subset, and see if that improves. And if that doesn't, if you're still at a loss, I think that fasting does have, especially short-term and long-term benefits in many autoimmune conditions, depending on the condition. I'm not sure, and of course, their Dr. Alan Goldhammer, Chef AJ, I believe, is coming out with a new book on fasting, right? And I
Yep, in
know
June, right?
he and you are coming to our Farm Days Festival
Yay.
later this year in New Jersey. So we'll ask him about that too, what the effects are of, let's say, a long-term water fast on psoriasis. I'm sure it couldn't hurt. I think I would touch base with Dr. Goldhammer. Perhaps shorter fasts, like 3-day fasts that are done monthly, could have an in many autoimmune diseases that I've seen, that eventually has a beneficial effect in turning them down.
Nice. Do you actually have to catch a plane right now?
Well, no, it's 11 o'clock tonight.
Well, yeah, well, we should let you go. Dr. Weiss, thank you so much for your thorough answers to all these wonderful questions. And if you did not get your question answered, just go to chefaj.com because I save them until they are answered.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, absolutely. We'll see you next month and safe travels and give our very best to Dr. Colin Campbell.
I shall.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Weiss. And thanks all of you for watching another episode of Chef AJ Live. Please come back tomorrow at 11 a.m. Pacific time for Dr. Nandita Shah, all the way from India. And she's going to be talking about digestive disturbances and making some delicious Indian food. Bye, Dr. Weiss. Take care.
Bye-bye, AJ.
Bye-bye.